from Iowa Public Radio News, this is a mini-series called The Procrastinator's Politics.
I just want to emphasize the degree to which we are in serious times, and this is a really serious thing. This is not entertainment.
They're bringing drugs.
You could put
not a reality.
Half of Trump's supporters is what I call the
contest for the presidency of the United States.
Too many of the justices are imposing their views.
She's promising for another Obama.
Let's go out and win the election. God bless you.
Election fatigue. That's the official term for how you might be feeling. A bit worn out, a bit overwhelmed, and maybe even a little bored. Some of you might be sick of the round-the-clock coverage of the candidates, and we don't always feel like we're hearing about the issues or policy plans. We're getting a little tired of conversations about candidate soundbites and Twitter feeds and personal lives. But you know that annoying thing people say? If you don't vote, you haven't earned the right to complain? Well, it's true. So if you've been blocking out the news and plugging your ears wherever you go, well, now is the time to tune back in. Your vote does matter. More importantly, your informed vote matters. I'm Shirley Wong. As a college student, I know a lot about procrastination. So let's study up. Last week, early voting started, and that means Iowans can cast their ballots basically any day before the election. Both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were in Iowa trying to lock down votes before anything happens that changes their voters' minds. Jack Williams went to the Trump rally in Council Bluffs on Wednesday.
There's nothing like a Trump rally, right?
Former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani introduced Trump to the crowd at the Mid-America Center in Council Bluffs. Supporters waved signs and cheered as Trump delivered the trademark lines that have been a big part of his campaign. Despite some bad reviews on his debate performance against Hillary Clinton earlier this week, Trump told the crowd he considered it a victory.
So we won every single online poll, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of voters. And then you sit back and you hear how she did so well in the debate. I don't think she did well in the debate at all. I don't think she did well at all.
Trump also reminded supporters to vote early starting today in Iowa. In the 2012 presidential election, more than 40% of voters in the state cast their ballots early. For Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Jack Williams.
And IPR's Clay Masters caught up with Hillary Clinton in Des Moines the next day.
Are you ready to go to the polls?
Hillary Clinton spoke to hundreds of supporters on a plaza in downtown Des Moines.
Well, luckily in Iowa, you can start today. Lots of folks don't have that opportunity across the country.
She brought up her debate with Republican Donald Trump and says she's running a campaign about issues, like calling for raising the minimum wage and expanding clean energy in America.
I want this election to be about something, not just against somebody.
In the 2012 election, almost 700,000 Iowans voted early. Since then, Republicans here have seen a slight increase in voters requesting absentee ballots, while Democrats have seen a large decrease. In Des Moines, I'm Clay Masters, Iowa Public Radio News.
Every week on Wednesday, we host Politics Day on River to River. Here's a portion of our conversation with political analysts Kedrin Bardwell of Simpson College and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa with host Ben Kiefer.
I wonder what you can tell us about what we know about undecided voters and what they're weighing in their minds. Do we know anything?
Well, you can tell a little bit by breaking down the survey results a little bit more, and I'll just go ahead and plug our Simpson College Robber Research poll, which came out about 10 days ago and basically was online with some of Loris and some of the other polls. Essentially, what we were finding is that if you frame it as just a two-way race, there's about 15% undecided. But if you give people all of those four options, as the Green Party voter just mentioned, you get down to about 7 or 8% undecided. So that's maybe, if we think of it this way, about half of the undecided voters are kind of truly undecided, and some of them may not end up showing it up in the end. And it seems as if maybe about half of them are essentially third-party, you know, libertarian or green voters, that if you give them the option, they'll choose it. But the question is, will they last these last few weeks as they think about whether or not that vote may be wasted if someone's not going to win the election?
Mm-hmm. Tim Hagel, this new survey from Loras College is a bit of good news for Clinton. Two other recent polls in the state have shown Trump leading by several points, so much so that some media sources are putting Iowa in the lean Trump category. How do you evaluate this poll next to the other polls of recent days?
Well, I'm always not a big fan of polls in general. They've really got no way to compare them particularly to the truth. We don't know what it is, and we talk about a snapshot. But that said, there is some value to them. But at this point, the polls, as we're getting within 40 days of the election, they need to do a couple of things. They need to be looking at likely voters and have some sort of a screen to that effect to try to make sure whether apparently some polling outfits will actually look at voter history. So if a person has, in fact, voted several times or is a regular voter, there's a better chance the person will vote this time. And if not, then not. Or just ask the kinds of questions that you can get at. Are you, in fact, going to vote? How excited are you about it? But then you also have to look at what the voter distribution is in the poll compared to what perhaps it has been in the past. So, for example, with the Loris poll, I looked at it, and I don't recall the exact numbers right off the top of my head, but it looked to me like it had oversampled Democrats, undersampled Republicans, and no-party voters in Iowa, at least compared to what we've seen in the last four presidential elections, where, roughly speaking, you have about Republicans about a point and a half, percentage and a half turnout more than Democrats in terms of that distribution, with about roughly 35% Republicans, 33% Democrats, and the rest no-party voters. And so if a poll doesn't have something pretty close to that particular distribution, it seems like it could be oversampling or undersampling one party or the other.
Mm-hmm. Your view on that, Kedron?
Yeah, I think that Tim's right about all the kind of the complexity of putting together a poll to represent the population of a state or the nation, and that you want to look into at least a little bit into the subgroup numbers to see if they kind of feel right or seem right based on past experience. But I would really encourage just all of the listeners, as they say in the polling world, keep calm and follow the averages rather than getting excited about one or the other poll. And we had a caller a minute ago, you know, say, well, I don't trust polls. you know, most people don't trust polls when they're not in the favor of the candidate that they support. So it tends not to be a generalized distrust, but, you know, I like them when they help my side, and I don't like them when they when they hurt. So just keep calm, follow the averages, the national averages. You know, we're leaning a little more Trump, and we'll see if Hillary gets a small bump from the debate. But, you know, look at these over time rather than as a one-off.
You see, it, in the aggregate of polls, it seems that Trump is a little bit ahead in Iowa, but not too long ago it showed Hillary ahead. Kedron, do you have any idea what happened there to cause that shift in so many polls, slightly in Trump's favor?
Yeah, now we broke it down a little bit in our Simpson-Raba poll, basically looked at a couple of factors. The one thing that we found that was probably standing out the most was that Trump had improved the Republican share of the vote with voters without a college degree, either with some college or with a high school degree. And he'd basically flipped that from what was a Democratic advantage of about 5 points for Obama to about a 10-point advantage for Republicans. So that's a pretty dramatic shift just in about 4 years. We did find that Trump might even be doing a little better, but he hadn't quite consolidated all the evangelicals in Iowa that he needed to. And so if he can continue to do that, and if you look at the recent numbers, Republicans are doing very well compared to Clinton in consolidating their own party vote. I do think he could win Iowa by a few percentage points.
Reaching out to undecided voters listening today, what do you think you'll do come November 8th? Vote for Clinton, vote for Trump, vote for a third party candidate. Not vote at all. Sit it out. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go back to our phone lines and talk with Bill in Des Moines. Are you undecided at this point, Bill?
I am actually not undecided now. I'm a reformed undecided voter.
Okay, what does that mean?
That means in the year 2000, I was in the undecided camp, and because I didn't think Al Gore was progressive enough, and I didn't like the way he distanced himself from the accomplishments of the Clinton administration, and I think Ralph Nader and the Green Party at that time was an attractive alternative. The thing is in Iowa that didn't matter much, but in Florida in 2000, Nader got about 96,000 votes, but Al Gore lost that election to George W. Bush by 537, if I remember correctly. I think that was the figure. It's right around there. And I think you know, I understand completely the sentiment in undecided voters, and especially in this election. My preference would be that we had no political parties, that every candidate ran as an independent and ran on their policies and their individual record. But we don't have that right now. And I think if you polled some of those 96,000 voters in Florida who voted for Ralph, I mean, take your vote back now and or change it. Would you not do that if you knew that that could prevent our war in Iraq and all of the bloodshed and the loss of treasury that went with that and all of the other policies that I'm sure they didn't agree with that were implemented during the Bush administration?
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's a short – I understand it. It's a short-sighted thing, and I think it's a protest vote. Bill Maher said recently about people looking at Hillary Clinton that they should recognize the difference between an imperfect friend – and a deadly enemy. And I think that that's really sums up what we're looking at here. Hillary Clinton is a flawed candidate, but to because she's flawed, to equate her potential presidency with Donald Trump, to say, you know, it's all the same, we should throw our hands up in the air and either make a protest vote or not vote, I just think that is idiocy.
Okay, Bill, thank you for your opinion, your view from Des Moines.
Thanks. You're welcome.
Kedron, does this, what you're hearing on the phones here from the last couple of callers match up with a theory? It seems to. As we get closer to election, the third-party candidates jump their third-party ship.
Yeah, that's what I was mentioning earlier, is that you never know how soft that third-party number actually is, and it can change even within the last few weeks as people take seriously the possibility that the candidate they like the least will be elected by their vote or non-vote. And that's the perversity of our two-party system. When you have those winner-take-all rules, if you vote for that third choice, you often actually advantage the person who is least like you on policy or least close to your position. There's fixes for that, but they're kind of in the la-la land, imaginary land of possible voting reforms, things like ranked choice voting or instant runoff, where you actually vote for, you know, you rank the candidates 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you transfer the votes, you know, from the lowest to the highest, and then you never end up essentially giving your vote to the person you like the least. But those are incredibly unlikely to ever pass.
I wanted to ask you about Iowa's congressional delegation, its role in the presidential election here. Of course, many of them up for reelection themselves, but all of Iowa's GOP congressional delegation supports Donald Trump. Senators Grassley, Ernst, also Congressman Bloom, Young, and King. Also, in addition to that, Governor Branstad. Tim Hagel, your thoughts on why in our state, when we see across the country many defectors against Donald Trump as the standard bearer for the GOP, for instance, former Virginia GOP Senator John Warner coming out today backing Clinton. Why don't we see that among any of the congressional delegation here in Iowa?
That's a question that's puzzled a number of reporters that have called me and say, you know, what's going on in Iowa? How come you see in the polls or you see the people supporting it? And one of the thoughts that I had about this is that when we had the caucuses, certainly the race was contentious. You know, we started out, of course, with 17 people on the Republican side. By the time we got to the caucuses, it was down to a dozen. But it still hadn't gotten that intense that we saw later in the campaign. And obviously, Iowa political folks or people that were tuned in were seeing what was happening beyond Iowa. But you didn't feel that immediacy here in Iowa that you saw in some of the other states. And I think that that helped to heal some of the hurt feelings and, you know, kind of build those bridges in ways that you didn't see in some other states and some other politicians. And so that allowed the Republican Party to come together a little bit more, a little bit faster in Iowa than it has in some other states. And sort of connecting that up to the previous two callers, you know, they were making the case for vote for Hillary Clinton because you really don't like Donald Trump. But for Republicans, especially some that maybe were in the never Trump camp, it's that same sort of argument for them, saying, well, look, okay, if you don't support Donald Trump, if you're a Republican, then you're basically helping Hillary Clinton. And if you think that she's terrible because she's corrupt or whatever, if that's your view, then despite the fact you may not like Trump, if you don't vote for him, you're helping Hillary Clinton. And so you're making that same argument. And like I said, as far as Iowa, in terms of the political establishment here, that they didn't get into that intense never Trump position. So for them, it was a little bit easier to come around and to actually support him.
Kedron Bardwell, your thoughts on Iowa's GOP congressional delegation in lockstep, no defectors there, all supporting Trump.
Yeah, and it's a little bit surprising for me, just kind of the amount of support they've given. I know there is always a question where you can watch, you know, how close they want to stand to Trump. Do they say that they're for Trump, or when they make their speech, are they just talking about how they don't like Hillary?
Supporting versus endorsing, whatever that difference should be.
That's been really interesting, and I've been trying to watch that as people like David Young or Kim Reynolds or others make their cases. There's definitely a variety of Trump support. In terms of how much you argue that he's the one for these various reasons versus, well, just the idea that Hillary we don't want. So I would add maybe one more thing to what Tim had said about what this tells us about the Republican Party or Republican ideology. I think we're learning a little bit with Trump that the belonging to the partisan team is a little more important to just rank and file Republicans than conservative policy or specific conservative policies. And it may be that the rank and file are driven more by concerns related to immigration, related to terrorism, related to racial issues, and not so much by, I think, the conservative intelligentsia or what they thought the Republican Party was driven by, and that was, you know, policies on lower taxes and less regulation and those types of issues. So I think this election has really revealed some of the divisions within the Republican Party about what that identity actually represents.
Kedrin Bardwell of Simpson College, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, about 10 minutes left, reaching out to undecided voters listening to the program this hour, 1-866-780-9100. Kim is in Des Moines. Says on my screen, you're undecided. Kim, is that the case?
Yeah, it really is. I went in kind of a Bernie fan, but afraid of how we were going to pay for things. But I've been drawn to that Trump side or Bernie side of kind of saying what needs to be said and not being, you know, a political puppet. However, Trump scares the bejesus out of me. And I think that Hillary, although I think she is very qualified to do this job, you know, I'm not sure that ethically she's who I want either. And then there's Gary Johnson, who I think I would vote for, except for what I've read about his stance on women is not necessarily supportive to women's rights. So I am completely lost.
Did you watch the debates on Monday night?
I can't watch debates. I get queasy, but I did follow it on Twitter.
Okay, you get queasy. So you didn't partake in watching it, consuming the media reports afterwards. I don't know if that influenced your undecided nature right now.
Well, I followed it on Twitter for the content, and then I checked the video highlights the next day. I don't appreciate the talking over each other, and when it gets out of control, I have trouble finding it a valuable way to choose a candidate. But based on what they said, I mean, Hillary's content was better.
Okay.
I think the fact checking even proved that, you know, she was truthful and Donald was still just kind of spewing whatever. But he also isn't afraid to kind of push the envelope. And I think government has been ineffective. Maybe he could do something.
If you're not still undecided, remember, early voting has begun. You don't have to wait another 30-ish days to make your decision. You can literally vote tomorrow. But before you do, let's listen to this conversation with Charles Grassley, who is up for re-election for his 7th term in the U.S. Senate. He's facing some criticism in this campaign. Senator Grassley is the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is responsible for vetting U.S. Supreme Court nominees. He's refused to hold hearings on President Obama's nominee to fill a vacancy on the Supreme Court. Grassley talks with Ben Kiefer about that and several other issues.
Let's get right to some news from yesterday. Congress overwhelmingly rejecting President Obama's veto of legislation allowing relatives of the victims of 9/11, the attacks on 9/11, to sue Saudi Arabia, the first override of this presidency about 4 months before the end of Obama's second term. I wonder if you'd explain your position on this vote, specifically the concerns that this could seriously hurt U.S. national security interests, possibly make the U.S. vulnerable in other courts around the world.
It will not make us vulnerable in other courts around the world because it explicitly prohibits lawsuits arising from acts of war. That was one of the issues that was brought up. So it claims that the law would lead to lawsuits against soldiers and diplomats is very misplaced. Without this legislation, courts would block terrorism-related claims that Congress intended to permit, and it simply enables families of 9/11 victims to pursue justice against those who sponsor acts of terrorism, and it's got to be on U.S. soil, and it does it by preventing them from invoking what lawyers would call sovereign immunity in cases involving attacks on U.S. soil. So it will not in any way allow individuals to be sued. It's only when it involves the Saudi Arabian government.
Join our conversation, Senator Charles Grassley, with us live, 1-866-780-9100. You can email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or 1-866-780-9100. Just less than 20 minutes to spend with Senator Grassley, but we'll try to get in as many listener questions and comments as possible. Senator, this was emailed to us from Greg in Waterloo. It gets to the heart of what I'm hearing from many Iowans in this very divisive campaign season, and I'll just read this to you from Greg in Waterloo. I voted for you in the past and enjoyed the Harkin-Grassley exchanges in the Senate. I understand and accept your desire for a conservative Supreme Court. That is your choice. Are you ready to take responsibility, Greg writes, for your connection to a candidate that espouses xenophobic, racist, misogynist, and birther ideas? Even though I have disagreed with you, I have respected your conservative views. He goes on, if you do not embrace the same views as Donald Trump, then you need to say it and tell the people you cannot vote for this man. What do you say to Greg from Waterloo?
Well, in regard to the court decisions, remember it's a two-step process. A president nominates. The president can nominate whoever he wants to. The Senate confirms. It's a two-step process. And I will make my decision on who's put on the court when the president makes a nomination, whether it's a Democrat president or a Republican president. But it's as simple as what I said. A president nominates. The Senate confirms. It's a two-step operation. There's no obligation to go beyond what we think ought to be done.
Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton has now said that if elected, she would look widely for candidates rather than to commit to Merrick Garland. I wonder if this would put you in the position to perhaps then hold hearings for Merrick Garland in the lame duck session after the election, if she should be elected and be president-elect.
No, we're very clear that we follow the precedent set by several people before we made this decision. You can go back to the Lyndon Baines Johnson nomination when senators said in the last year of that presidency that the new president should make the decision. So Nixon filled that position. We have the statements by then Senator Biden, Senator from New York made those statements as well, that we ought to, I should say Senator Reid and Senator Schumer made similar decisions that in the last year of a presidency, you should let the new president make the decision. And that's kind of where we are, because you can't have one rule when you have a Republican president, another rule when you have a Democrat president. So we decided that who's ever elected in November would make that decision after January 20th, 2017.
Mm-hmm. Back to Greg in Waterloo to make sure he gets an answer to the question he had. He said, if you do not embrace the same views as Trump, then you need to say it. Do you embrace the same views as Donald Trump?
Well, I think it's as simple as this, that sometimes you agree with any president, sometimes you disagree with any president. And it's the same way with Donald Trump.
In large part, you agree with his values, his character, his vision for the country?
What I look at specific issues, but it really doesn't matter to me what a president thinks. He's head of the executive branch. I'm a member of the legislative branch. We have separate constitutional powers, and I will exercise my powers and my judgment within the powers that the Constitution gives me. When I agree with the president, I agree with the president, and when I don't agree with the president, then you have disagreement. Pretty simple under the Constitution.
You said it doesn't really matter what the president thinks?
From the standpoint of my role as a legislator, I'm a member of an independent branch of government.
But you support Donald Trump, so
yeah,
you must support his thinking, right?
This is basic government.
Mm-hmm.
Basic government. We have a tripartite system of government. I have my jobs to do, and whether you have a Republican president or a Democrat president, sometimes you agree with them, and sometimes you don't agree with them. And maybe in a lot of instances, my disagreements have maybe been sometimes greater with certain Republican presidents, let's say like Reagan, on how much money ought to be spent on defense during the 1980s, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
Just one example. I led the battle to freeze the defense budget in the 1980s when we had a Republican president, when there was just a minority of Republicans in the United States Senate that felt the same way I did, but we had a majority of the Senate.
I wonder, you and all other Republican members of Congress from Iowa have been steadfast in your support of Donald Trump. Do you think the fact that Iowa's Republican leaders are all endorsing Trump is one of the reasons that he is doing relatively well here in Iowa, according to polls, even leading Hillary Clinton in many of the polls?
I had this discussion this morning with some people, and it's kind of an anomaly from our point of view when you figure that we Republicans have only carried Iowa 2004 in the last five or six presidential elections, and it's really difficult for me to explain. And I'm not sure that I get an explanation from people that bring it up. And you obviously ask the question because you would like to know, and I'd like to figure it out too. But I guess from the standpoint of not agreeing with Hillary Clinton on very many things, that I'm glad that we might have a chance of having a Republican president.
I guess to simplify the question, which I think you've hit the nail on the head there, is do you think your support has helped Donald Trump in the polls here in Iowa?
No, I don't.
You don't? Why would you endorse or support a candidate if you don't think he's helped in polls?
No, you're the two questions you're asking me have no connection.
Explain that.
Well, explain it. You asked me I thought about his standing in Iowa.
And if the endorsement of all the Republican members of Congress had anything to do with his relatively good showing in the polls currently.
I'm not sure that all the members of Congress have endorsed him.
Iowa Congress members who are in the Republican Party haven't they?
I don't know for sure.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the other issues that we've seen in the news, if we could. We have about 10 minutes left here. I wonder if you could comment about, the EpiPen controversy. You wrote to the maker of the EpiPen, Mylan, with questions about the product's price increases after hearing concerns from Iowans. You said you felt unsatisfied with the response you received. It didn't answer all your questions. Tell us, what is the best way to curb the rising price of pharmaceutical costs?
Well, first of all, you've got to look at EpiPen, that they have a monopoly, and they shouldn't have a monopoly. And if they didn't have a monopoly, I'll bet the price wouldn't be as high as it is. And so one of my letters was to the FDA about any alternatives that are in the pipeline to come up to compete with EpiPen, with Mylan and their product. And I think that that would go a long ways. And I believe that we need to make sure that the price is legitimate. And I don't see the price going up in 7-year period of time by 400 and some percent as legitimate, particularly when the basic product within EpiPen has been around since 1901, and that we need to raise these questions legitimate. And they've already responded not in a very adequate way, because they should just reduce the price. But the fact that they're bringing online another product less expensive to compete with it almost within 2 weeks after we raised the question, the fact that they give a $300 rebate to certain people is understand that it's very difficult for them, I think, as well. And I think the best thing to do is to get FDA moving on additional competitive product. I think that's the way to reduce the price. Without a doubt, I think that they have taken advantage, a very serious advantage, of a product that's badly needed for people that have allergies to peanuts and nuts.
Mm-hmm. U.S. Senator Charles Grassley joining us live. We have a little less than 10 minutes left. Let's try to get in as many listener calls, emails. Caleb is joining us from Ankeny. Hi, Caleb. We're short of time, but please, let's hear your question for Senator Grassley.
Yes, Chuck. I got a question for you. Do you support the Bakken pipeline? And if so, do you support eminent domain abuse of people that pay taxes on their land and then corporations come in and just abuse their land? Do you support that?
Well, you're talking about something. If you ask me about the pipeline carrying oil from Canada down to the Oklahoma, I voted for that because that comes within the realm of the Congress of the United States to make that decision, because it costs the national border. The pipeline you're asking me about doesn't cost cross the national border, and it's within the jurisdiction of the four states to make that decision. So I'm not involved in that decision, and I guess that when I know the importance of pipelines to deliver, if you see a map of pipelines in the United in Iowa, there or the entire United States, they're all over the map for a particular state. In fact, I have a pipeline going across my farm as just one example. You wonder the controversy of it, but I think if I had a farmer digging up my farmland, I'd be very concerned about it as well. But as long as state law is followed, and it's entirely a state decision, unlike the pipeline from Canada down, carrying oil from Canada down to the into the United States, that's a federal issue. What you're talking about is a state issue, and I find it pretty difficult for me sitting in Washington to question decisions by the leaders of four different states to go ahead with it.
Senator Grassley, on an ag-related question that I also put to Patty Judge, I'd like to have you address sure. Water quality. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, also former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, has urged Iowa lawmakers to act on water quality, saying that lawmakers should, in his words, lock the door and not come out until they've got a plan. How should lawmakers act to improve water quality in Iowa, across the nation? Should the state or federal government regulate to solve the problem?
Well, the federal government already regulates the problem.
But down to a certain extent, not down to these smaller streams that feed into our lakes and rivers, right?
Well, the extent to which the water quality is regulated, the head of EPA at the federal level was at the state fair 3 years ago, and she made a statement that the plan that Iowa had in place I don't know if she said it would work or that it was plausible or what she said, but it's very approving of it. And so Iowa moves ahead. If at any time Iowa violates federal law, the national federal EPA can step in.
Yesterday, after nearly 7 months, the Congress agreed to allocate over $1 billion to help fight the spread of and the effects of the Zika virus, not affecting us here in Iowa yet, but certainly in Florida and some other southern climes, Senator Grassley. The deal part of a broader agreement to continue to fund the government after the fiscal end year ends on Friday. Why did this get tied up in such a partisan fight when it all sides agree it is a public health emergency?
It's pretty hard to explain when all 54 Republicans supported it. It's probably a question that's more appropriate for Democrat senators than it is a Republican senator to answer that, because I don't know really what the scheme was behind Democrats not voting for it. But that's where you'd have to go for your answer.
But
we did finally get a bipartisan agreement to move ahead.
Yeah, because of the, I understand that the language was dropped barring funding from going to Planned Parenthood clinics, right?
Well, then that was a House of Representative position, and you would have to, there were several things that were put in to the House of Representatives on that issue. But the Senate agreed to take those out. The real issue is getting at the Zika issue, and this finally did it, thank God.
Let's go to John in Rhodes. John, welcome to our program. Running short of time, but we're glad to have you on the program with Senator Charles Grassley.
Yeah, John, glad to have you here. I'd like to hear your question.
I wondered about term limits. It seems to me you said you have supported them in the past, and while they didn't affect you, or why they didn't.
Well, if they'd gone into effect, they would have affected me. I voted. We've had the vote once in the years I've been in the Congress, and maybe that once is the only time it's ever been voted on in the entire 230 years of Congress, and I voted for it.
Mm-hmm. Can you say when?
Okay,
you,
yeah, it doesn't affect yourself, huh? As part of your...
Well, it would affect me if it got to be part of the Constitution. It would affect everybody.
Yeah, but...
mm-hmm. The larger question, Senator Grassley, when do you plan to retire? You're obviously in it for another 6 years. Should you win re-election? When would be the time for you to call it quits in the Senate?
I think you ought to ask me after this election, because I got to be in the Senate for another term before that question would even be applicable.
Mm-hmm. Let's field another listener question. This is from Amanda, who would like to hear about your bipartisan efforts. She writes, I've been hearing mostly about your controversial positions. I'm not happy with a lot of decisions regarding those, especially blocking the Garland hearings. The senator has been an asset to the state in the past, but I feel like I need more reassurance that he's working for the state of Iowa first and the Republican Party second, instead of the other way around, in order to vote for him again. That's from Amanda.
Yeah. Why would she think that for all the years I've been in the United States Senate, I hold town meetings to be in touch with the people of Iowa? Not only through mail, not only through telephones, but actually face-to-face meetings. So I think the best thing to say to her would be that the 30 bills that have come through the Judiciary Committee since I've been chairman have been all bipartisan bills. Not a single partisan bill has come out of that committee. The tax relief that I worked out with Democrat Senator Baucus when I was chairman of the Finance Committee would be another perfect example of that. The False Claims Act that I worked out with Democratic Congressman Berman a generation ago has brought $48 billion back into the federal treasury. Senior citizens have a prescription drug program because I was chairman of the chairman of the Finance Committee when we established Part D of Medicare. And then I'll give one more example. Senator Kennedy's dead now, but he and I worked for 6 years to get the Family Opportunity Act passed.
Okay.
So nothing gets done in the United States Senate if it isn't somewhat bipartisan, because of the 60-vote requirement.
We have 1 minute left. I'd like to make sure we get a question on our flooding here in 2016 for you. Money for flood protection in Cedar Rapids, Senator, has been approved but not allocated. What can you do to ensure money for flood protection gets approved?
Yeah. Thank God it's not a big lift, for this reason, that when we have disaster relief, there's money put in at the beginning of the fiscal year. You never know what you're going to need for the next 12 months. But if it runs out during that 12-month period of time, it's generally replenished without any controversy whatsoever.
Senator Charles Grassley speaking with IPR's Ben Kiefer. Coming up next week, we'll do a preview of the first congressional district race and an interview with Charles Aldrich, the Libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate. I'm Shirley Wong. This has been The Procrastinator's Politics. And join us here next week on iowapublicradio.org.